G'day, I'm Troy.
And I'm Brian.
And we're the hosts of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist, an ex-evangelical podcast.
We used to be loyal members and leaders in Australian Christian megachurches, but we're not anymore.
I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist is an honest and hilarious peek behind the curtain at the weird, the worrying, and sometimes traumatic world of evangelicals and Pentecostals.
We share our stories, we interview prominent guests in the global ex-evangelical space, and provide a platform for others to tell their stories about their time in evangelicalism and their journey out.
Shortlisted at the recent Australian Podcast Awards, I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist gives you a unique global perspective into one of the fastest growing religions in the world from the people who actually lived it.
You can find us wherever you get your podcasts and iwasateenagefundamentalist.com.
So my wife has a deep and persistent fear that shows up in dreams sometimes. The worst thing she can imagine would be falsely to be imprisoned, to be arrested for something she didn't do and put in prison and not be able to get out. I don't know that this is an uncommon fear. I mean, they make a lot of movies about people that are falsely imprisoned, which I think sort of speaks to the idea that that fear is in the zeitgeist. And what's funny is that most of the people I know that worry about false imprisonment have never been inside a prison, have never visited anyone in jail. But boy, you really want to be afraid of prison? Go visit one of those places. Go on the inside sometimes. That's a whole other thing. And the reason why I'm talking about prison and jail and all that stuff is because on this week's episode, right here, right now, in just a few minutes, I'm going to introduce you to I'm going to let you listen in on the conversation I had with Robert Rooks. And Robert Rooks is he's not somebody you know. And like in some ways, I always worry about these episodes where I bring you somebody that you've never heard of and maybe talking about something that you're not that interested in. And I go, gosh, I hope people hang in there because there's something really golden here. And Robert Rooks is a guy who himself has never been to prison. He's a beautiful human being. He's had a beautiful life. But as a young person, he had friends who got victimized by crime, and he had friends that got swept up in the criminal justice system, and he had friends. And eventually, you know, when he got into college and out of college, he was like, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to try to do something good in the world around prison stuff. And early in his career, he got hooked up with Meek Mill, who, if you're from Philly, which I am, you would have known Meek Mill as like one of the great rappers to ever come out of Philly. If you're not from Philly, you might know Meek Mill because a number of years ago, he was at the center of a huge controversy because 10 years after his original offense, he got busted on a probation violation and he got thrown into prison. Famous rapper gets thrown into prison. And because he was a famous rapper and had famous friends and connected, this whole movement grew up around him where they were like, this is ridiculous, like what he's being busted for. And anyway, Meek Mill went into prison and got broken out of prison by like Jay-Z and Kim Kardashian and Robert Kraft, who owns the New England Patriots. Like he had this whole all-star team of people working to get him out. And when he got out, he started this organization called Reform, which is about reforming parole and probation here in the United States. And Robert, my new pal Robert, runs that organization. And this will be an interesting conversation for many of you because like this is not about like, Reform is doing great work. We should support them and send their money. He's going to really come out with like, what do everyday people do to make this world better around prison reform? And there is stuff that you and I can do in our own world that has nothing to do with writing letters to our congressmen. And like, Robert's got some really good stuff. And it's a good story, and he's a good guest. And this is a good conversation, and I'm really excited to share it with you. So here it goes, me and Robert Rooks on Humanize Me. Hey, thanks. Robert, I'm guessing you've probably done your share of podcast interviews over the last couple of years.
I've done a handful.
So I know there are a few different varieties. On this one, we really endeavor to have a conversation. So, you know, it's not just like I ask questions and you answer. It's like, you know, can ask me stuff back, or if you want to circle back on something, say, hey, but the thing I really wanted to talk about was that.
Right.
There's no etiquette here, except like if we were having coffee.
Great. I love that.
Okay.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah. And if there's any point at which you're like, oh, yeah, I could say that better, just say, hey, I could say that better, and then say it better.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
So what I thought, just since I don't know you, and I'm not, what my instinct is to be like, oh, Robert, tell me your story. But what I realize is like for other people, I'm only interested in your story because I know a little bit about what you're working on. So I thought like what I would do is I would like start with, what are you working on? And then I'm going to probably ask you like, how'd you get into all that stuff?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Bart, John, really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, to have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
About the work that I do, where I'm from. Looking forward to our exchange. What I'm working on now is I'm the CEO of an organization called Reform Alliance. Reform is an organization birthed out of the unjust incarceration of rap artist Meek Mill. About 5 years ago, he was incarcerated for popping a wheelie on a motorbike.
Yeah, I'm from Philadelphia originally.
Oh, you are?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I didn't know.
Yes, like so the last time I was in Philly, you know, I visit my parents there and whatnot. I was with my son. And we were driving around. We were in North Philly, and he was space. And some guys came by us on four wheelers.
Yeah.
And he was like, "That's the whole Meek Mill thing." And like he sort of he broke it down a little bit. But like that was a famous case. But I don't think many people know what was Meek Mill's case all about, really.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating, and it really just wasn't one case. It was his entire experience in the justice system. He was incarcerated when he was 18. For something he said he didn't do. And the arresting officer has since been found out to be someone that has set people up and has been held accountable for that. So Meek said he didn't do it. He said he's done other things, but he didn't do what he was arrested. But that landed him on probation. And he had a judge while on probation.
Now, wait, it's funny because probation and parole are two different things. Probation's what, when they're like, you did something wrong. We're not going to send you to jail right away. We're going to put you on probation.
Correct. In lieu of incarceration.
He was on probation.
He was on probation. I mean, some people go to jail for some time waiting for their proceedings, but then get probation. So that's in lieu of.
Okay.
Whereas parole is you've served time in prison and you're getting out perhaps a little early because of a number of things. Good time, prison overcrowding. They put you on parole. And you get a parole officer, just like you get a probation officer. And their strategy for supervision is oftentimes the same, which is why we talk about probation and parole.
And theoretically, the goal here is to hold you accountable to be a good person from here on out. Like, you're going to show us that you're working. You're going to show us that you're not using drugs. You're going to prove to us that you deserve to be free.
So the origins of the probation system goes back to 1841, a guy by the name of John Augustus. John Augustus caught wind that a judge was about to sentence a guy to jail for being a public drunkard, alcoholic. And John intervened and told the judge, asked the judge to let him work with the guy, see if he can make things better. And when the guy returned back to the courts, he was clear-eyed, could speak. The judge was amazed, like, wow, you've done something really good here, John. I have a couple more people you should see. And John was then given the term the father of probation in this country for that. So the origins of it is helping people address their root cause. You know, oftentimes when people go to prison or jail, that something broke down, something happened. The idea from my perspective of the correction system or the criminal justice system, or even when on probation parole, we should help people address those root causes so they don't come back.
Yeah.
That's what John Augustus did, and that was the founding of the probation system in this country.
So theoretically, Meek Mill gets convicted of doing something wrong, And the judge says, you know what? We could send you to prison, but it would be better for you to do something more productive than going to prison. So we're going to put you on probation.
Well, that was as if it would have happened in 1841. This is 2000, what? This was, what, 10 years ago? No, 5 years ago. So this is 2018.
Yeah.
When he first went in, it was 2008, I think, 2009. That's not what we have right now in our justice system.
So when they put him on probation, what were they trying to do?
Well, I can't speak for them in terms of what they were trying to do. But the situation he ended up in was one where he had to adhere to ridiculous rules and stipulations that told him where he could go, when he could go. And he had a judge that had an inappropriate obsession with him and his career. The judge was also from Philadelphia and would tell him what songs to make, what venues to go to and perform. She just would control. He had a girlfriend at the time. You may know her. Her name was Nicki Minaj. And she would call them back into the chambers and give them a talking to. And so this judge was just not right. And this judge is still in the court system today. She's not seeing any cases, but she's an elected officer of the courts. And so,
wow. So this judge, like when he got arrested the first time, he was already enough of a rapper, enough of a well-known person that the judge was like, ooh, I've got somebody notable under my control. I'm going to shape their life. I'm going to appoint myself their guide.
The operative word is control.
Yeah.
Right. She said, you know, I have this person, this rapper under my control, and I'm going to do with them what I please. And I'm going to tell them where they can go, how they can make money. And she did that for 10 years. Like, she did that for a long time. And so this one incident was when Meek was shooting a music video and popping a wheelie on a motorbike. And she caught wind of that and hauled him to the courts and gave him a 2 to 4 year prison sentence. Prison sentence, 1 week in the hole for popping a wheelie on a motorbike. And for your listeners, the hole is solitary confinement.
Yeah.
Right. It's when you're in this closed box 24 hours a day, 23 hours a day. And he was given that for popping a wheelie on a motorbike. She was that upset with him. Now, what was different, she treated him like this the whole time. She would take his freedom away and tell him what to do. I mentioned that. But what was different was that this was after 2018. If you remember, you're from Philly. What happened that time? Eagles wins the Super Bowl. Meek's song is like the spirit animal behind that Super Bowl run. I mean, he's an international superstar at this point. Before, people knew him, right?
He was a Philly guy.
He was a Philly guy. But after the Super Bowl, Meek became an international star and had made friends, influencers, and people that like to be around him. And if you ever meet him, you would like to be around him too. He's a great guy. And people got wind of what happened. Some of his new friends joined him in court that day. And when she sent him to prison, it shocked the people that were there and it shocked the people that heard about it. And they wanted to do something about it. They wanted to get their friend out of jail.
They had never seen that part of the system.
No, they haven't. And Meek would talk about it, right? Meek would tell people how he was treated, but like, oh yeah, you're just, but when they saw it, they experienced it.
Yeah.
They're like, what?
And that was when the whole Free Meek Mill got rolling.
The birth of the Free Meek movement, correct?
Yeah.
What those people that experienced what happened that day and the outrage they felt. They went to the press, media, the streets, and people organized. What I love about Reform, the organization that I run, it's one of the few organizations that was birthed out of the culture, right? It was the culture that stood up and said, this is not acceptable, right? And we're talking about people that are shaping the culture, standing up, held concerts, put money in the fund to get them out, gave money to grassroots groups to organize. And it wasn't easy. It took them months to do it, but they did it and he was released.
But there was no Reform then, right? Like, that's not who they were giving money to. Like, there were just...
No, yeah.
What, was a GoFundMe campaign? How were they...
I wasn't around, so I don't know what the details of that were.
Yeah.
But when Meek came out of prison, to his credit, and I've said this before, he could have, you know, went to studio, rapped about his experience, and no one would have criticized him. He could have said a big thank you and I love you to the people that organized, and
could have made it all about his end. I was in, I'm out, end of story.
Yeah. And thank you so much for supporting. Right. But he didn't do that. He came out and he talked about the experience of people on supervision like him, and created a charge, made a charge, and asked people to think about the 4 million people that are on supervision in this country, that are free but not free, living their lives like he did, and that we should do something about it. And that's how reform was born.
And so when I say, what are you working on now? You're like, we're working on reforming supervision, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this will sound funny, but like, that's a horrible story, the Meek Mill story.
Yeah.
Like, ostensibly a happy ending, right? But like, he's an extraordinary person because he had Robert Kraft and Jay-Z and all these people like following his case. And then when he went into prison, they were like, whoa. But the average kid on supervision, like the average young person that gets in trouble with the law and they get put on probation. Again, like your dude in England who invented probation, the father of probation, like he had a benevolent idea there, right?
Yeah.
What if instead of sending him to prison where he's going to be around hardened criminals, I take him home with me and I teach him some manners and I get him a job. Is there a good form of probation? Like, could probation be a good thing?
Yeah. So we as an organization, we're calling for transforming probation and parole to being what it originally was, right? A place where you go to get supportive services, you get connection to help, to get back on your feet, right? Address the root cause of whatever happened or broke down for you in your life. Let's address that. We believe that there are officers all across this country that became probation and parole officers to do that, but realized that they found themselves in the middle of a political matter, right? So how probation and parole is governed in this country, it's different state by state, but it's largely a political issue.
What do you mean by that?
Like? Yeah, the politics is this, that they are told that they don't want the people that they supervise on 10 o'clock news committing a new crime. And they need to manage people around that fact, that if they, under their watch, commit a new crime, they will be held accountable as officers. And so that takes where it used to be about rehabilitation, it quickly, right, it's about punishment. Oh, you didn't show up for your meeting today. I don't know what's going on in your life. I'm sending you back. I found out you were in a neighboring town. I don't know what's going on. I'm sending you back. You got a ticket. We know a guy that made an illegal U-turn, got a ticket. Parole officer sent him back. I mean, there are tons of stories. So yeah, Meek is unique, but his story is not. This is happening all over the country. So your question was, is there where probation...
A good version.
Yeah, I think there are states like California, counties like El Dorado County in California or in Massachusetts, where they're trying to find that middle ground. They're trying to move away from punishment model to a rehabilitation model. And let me give you a little bit more specifics on that. El Dorado County realized that a good number of the people that were on probation in their county were homeless. So the probation department purchased the house, moved them in. Their job was to help make sure the house governed accordingly. And they get credit for that. Now, a lot just happened right there, right? You took someone that's homeless, you put them in a place where they have shelter. Two, you're teaching them and giving them credit for how to run a house and or how to be a participant in a house with other people. So they're gaining skills there. And that's include, you know, getting food and managing money, all that. And then you incentivize all by saying you get off probation earlier if you don't have issues or incidents and if you do what you're supposed to do. To me, that's the John Augustus model, right? That's going back to why probation was founded. That's happening right now in counties in California. In Massachusetts, they have found ways to tap into federal healthcare dollars. And when people, you know, have mental health or substance abuse issues, they don't send them back to jails or prisons, which is in most places our largest mental health provider, are in jails and prisons. That's not where we should be providing mental health services, to be clear about that. But in Massachusetts, they have found a way to tap into those dollars and move people to get mental health support and treatment and substance abuse support and treatment instead of going to prison and jail. That, to me, is the Johnny Gustis model. So, yeah, we do have forward-thinking probation departments that are trying to do the right thing.
Let me bring it back to you in the sense of, like, so Meek Mill gets released from prison after this grassroots movement raises awareness. And I remember that part of it too, because the judge, everybody was like, this judge is crazy. This judge is a mess.
And she's like, still there.
And she's still there for whatever reason, but like, she's no longer in charge of young men's and women's lives the way she was, because she was clearly like off the chain.
Right.
But what was interesting was, okay, so then this grassroots movement gets Meek Mill released and he decides, hey, listen, this is a larger systemic problem. The probation system is not a good thing the way it is. And so does he go like, I heard about a guy named Robert. I'm going to call him. Like, how do you get involved in this?
Well, okay, so a couple of things happen in between time. Michael Rubin, who was one of his closest friends, who's also a Pennsylvania guy, they decide to co-found the Reform Alliance, right? They went into partnership.
They're like, we're going to start an organization.
They started a new organization, and they pulled all the people that they relied on, right, to get Meek out, to help fund or put seed money in the founding of Reform Alliance. And
hence your star-studded list of donors.
Yeah, hence my awesome board. Great group of people, super smart. I mean, they're incredible. And so for 2 years, Reform was headed up by Van Jones. So Van was the founding CEO of Reform Alliance.
Is that a name I should know?
Yeah, you should. I mean, if you watch CNN or he does stuff on very public stuff, was in the White House.
Yeah, because I feel like I've heard of Van Jones. Yeah, it sounds like, yes. You know.
So he was hired for the first 2 years to run in. Ben does a really good job of getting organizations off the ground, and he did that reform. I was kind of running my organization. I'm the co-founder of similar organization, not as widely known, called Alliance for Safety and Justice. I was called and they asked if I wanted to run it. It was in 2020 2021.
Okay, so you were already in this game?
Yeah, I've been doing it for 25 years.
All right, so I know how Meek Mill got energized around parole and probation. Like, where did you come in? You grew up?
Dallas, Texas. Yeah, Dallas, Texas, 80s and 90s. I saw my working class neighborhood get impacted and change overnight, pretty much by the crack cocaine epidemic in the 80s. And then in the 90s, we experienced a lot of violence. And it was at my best friend's funeral that I decided that I wanted to do something about this and work to make sure the next generation doesn't experience what I was experiencing. So I made a commitment.
But were you experiencing it firsthand or secondhand? Like it sounds like you're like, I'm getting this impression like you were there, but you weren't in it.
Yeah, I was an athlete. I loved football. I played football. I was a scholarship college athlete. But when you're in Southern Dallas, I was in Oak Cliff. When I was younger, we moved to DeSoto. Your friends in DeSoto, come from Oak Cliff, and then you still have friends from Oak Cliff, and we were losing friends from both places.
Yeah. I mean, there's no reason why you would know my background, but I have a little bit of a weird life story in that, like, I became like this hyper evangelical Christian when I was in high school. And this first thing that they asked me to do for Jesus was to run a summer camp in Camden, New Jersey, right across the river from Philly. Uh-huh. And so for the next like 25 years, I was all about inner city youth work.
You lost kids too.
Oh, many, you know, and like was around a lot of stuff. But like, you know, I come from a lily white suburban background. So people don't necessarily would not know that like I had spent a lot of time, and I started an organization that recruited young people to work in the inner city. And so like I was in Oakland and Atlanta and Chicago and like I was in a lot of neighborhoods working with a lot of kids. And so in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
So like crack.
Yeah.
All that stuff. And what was interesting was you would be around it. And like, I felt like the best kids I worked with, like the honor student athlete who went off to Harvard, it didn't matter. Like, it felt like almost like if you were black, you knew somebody that was involved in the system that had been hurt by the system.
Yeah. Like, so I would take that the step forward. It's kind of like
if you were poor.
When we think of South African apartheid, black people in South Africa all experienced apartheid, right? Whether you got arrested or not, whether someone in your family was murdered or not. And Black folks during that time all experienced this. If you lived in the cities, even if you lived in the suburbs, like you experienced the impact of the crack epidemic and the violence that came after that.
Yeah. If you would ask any kid I knew in all of West Philadelphia, you said, like, do you have a close family member who has struggled with drugs? Like, everyone would raise their hand. Do you have a close family member who's presently incarcerated? Everyone would raise their hand.
And the third question, do you have a close family member that you lost?
Right.
And everyone would raise their hand, right? And
yeah,
that was many of our experience. And so back to your question, it was that experience that made me upset and wanting to do something about it.
How old were you when you were like, again, I grew up in church. I'm not a church guy anymore. I'm like this secular humanist guy now. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But back when I was in there, like we would ask somebody, when did you give your life to Jesus?
Right.
You know, when did you come down the aisle? When did you make your decision for Christ? When did you make your decision to try to be involved in reforming the criminal justice system?
Yeah, so I was 19. It was at my best friend's funeral. And this is a guy that I had grew up with, known since the fourth grade, and he was murdered on his porch. And I was sitting there looking at him and just not believing, you know, what I was seeing and experiencing. And I'm like, we got to do something about this. This is not okay. And this is after a number of other friends had lost their lives. I mean, to look at that fourth grade yearbook and to look at how many people, how many young boys, never got a chance to be adult men. It's devastating.
Did that shape your education? Like from that point on, did you take, like, what did you study?
Yeah, I went into psychology. Mm-hmm. There was a part that really captured me, was African psychology, and was just reading the works of folks like Wade Nobles and others that just looked at how it gave me a way of understanding what was going on. In ways that it was not about blaming the people that were in it. It was not about blaming. It was like, no, there are conditions that exist whereby these things happen in these conditions. When you have poverty, you have the crack epidemic, and you have a capitalistic economy, and you drop they drop right in the middle of the neighborhood. These things happen.
So it sounds like you were actually studying African American psychology.
But it was root. But the analysis was rooted in African. It would call it African psychology.
Really? Okay. All right.
Yeah. It helped me channel what I was upset about a little bit more, to start looking at systems, the way systems were set up. And then I went and got my master's in social work at University of Connecticut. And there, I got my undergrad at Prairie View A&M University, which is HBCU in Houston. Then I got my master's at UConn. And the beauty about that program is it's half academic and half practicum. So I was out in the field, and I was placed in the Upper Albany neighborhood, knocking on doors. Upper Albany was, at that time, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country, and dealt with a lot of violence. And so that's where I wanted to be. That's what inspired me to want to do something. So I would knock on people's doors to talk to them about quality of life. Like, what do they want to see happen? And I remember so much of the conversation evolving around open air drug markets and how kids couldn't play outside and be safe. So the community rallied around, and I remember this day so well. They rallied around, and a lot of those guys that were on the corner selling drugs openly were arrested, and folks were like happy, right? You know, because that's what we think should be happening, right? So folks were arrested. People in the community were happy. We're talking about all Black people here, right? And I remember 7 days later, about 8 days later, knocking on doors, and folks saying there was more shooting this last week than at any time prior. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what happened? We fought. We fixed this problem, right?
No, you created a power vacuum.
There you go. There you go. We created a bigger problem. And that was my lesson. It's my practical lesson. And what I was learning earlier in undergrad was you have a system, and you remove people, you have a system where people are making money, and then removing those people creates competition, and that competition creates violence. And that's what we call the war on drugs. The war on drugs created that. And the misnomer for so many people is that they believe the war on drugs actually was about drugs. And it wasn't. It was about the control of people and communities. And I'm so glad I learned that lesson early on. And I made a commitment to do something about it.
Yeah, for those of you that don't want to go to social work school, like I think it's season 2 of The Wire, right?
There you go.
I mean, like, I remember watching that show and I thought like, wow, finally a show that has some perspective on what the nature of the game
Supply is. Supply side strategies don't work.
Yeah.
It just don't work. It's like you have to figure out, this government has to figure out what it's going to do about demand. Until we do that, we're always going to be a step behind.
Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with a guy named Johan Hari. Uh-huh. He's a writer. He wrote a really well-known book about addiction called Chasing the Scream. But he always points to this one experiment that they did where they put rats in a cage with a bottle of water and a bottle of heroin laced water. And once the rats tried the heroin, they would just keep going back to the heroin, 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 until they would die. They would stop eating. They would stop sleeping. They would just kill themselves with heroin. And at one point, the person was like, you see the addictive quality of heroin? Do you see the problem here? And he said it was years later that another psychologist said, you know, those rats are in a cage with nothing to do. He said, I wonder what would happen if we created like a habitat for rats with like interesting things to climb on and other rats to mate with and water and obstacles and wheels to run on and beautiful plants. And we'll still put heroin and water bottles there. And what they found was, is that when the rats were in this like very stimulating environment, they drank water. They weren't that interested in heroin. And he always pointed out, he's like, people will use heroin when their prospects are, it's like opioids now. Like when people are despairing, when people have no hope, when people have no prospects, then all of a sudden these drugs become very attractive and appealing. But like, if you really wanted to cut it off, like cut it off on the demand, like 100%. Create people that have opportunities and things to do.
Things change. It's always been a demand strategy. Like that would help us address this issue. However, all of the resources, and I do mean all the resources, are on supply, right? You know, very little. People don't even talk about prevention. Maybe there's a new conversation out about prevention. Harm reduction is finally getting some attention, right? After years.
Well, the opioid crisis has actually been helpful because...
For this conversation now, yeah.
Yeah. Because when it was just Meek Mill and a bunch of kids down there in the neighborhood, I don't think people were really thinking carefully about like, what are the reasons why people start using drugs? But when it was Cousin Billy in the suburbs using opioids, people were like, oh, wait a second. And so I think there's a greater awareness of, hey, we have to address the core needs of the person using the drugs if we want to stop this cycle.
You know, what you just said is such a sad but true reality, right? It's so right. Sad. It's like you have to see people that look like you in order for you to understand humanity. Right. Like before you can respond and treat people fully human, the person impacted has to look like you. That's exactly what's going on. And I've heard law enforcement officials fess up to this exact point, that once they started to see their cousins and nephews, exactly what you said, all of a sudden treatment is more of an option.
And I have to tell you, when I couldn't believe in Christianity anymore and I became secular, like, I read a lot of science books because what I was looking for was a new narrative that would motivate me to be a good person, because I still wanted to be a good person. While I was reading those books, I think like one of the things that I learned about like evolution and our primary commitment to our own DNA and to pushing it forward, sort of the selfish gene thing, not that your genes make you selfish, but that you tend to look out for your own, I've sort of just gone like, that's just a scientific fact. Like people care more about their family than they care about the family next door. They care more about their tribe than they do about the tribe next door. So in a part of me, like when I hear all those songs, like, we should love everybody equally the same. I go like, yeah, that's not what I don't think it's possible.
Now you're talking about the construction of race, right? And so how are people taught who their own is, That's very interesting.
On some fundamental level, on a biological level, I go like, I know my child is closer to me than the kid next door. Cause like, that's my kid. And so like my cousin, you know, we tend to be more. And so a part of me goes like, until it's your cousin, until it's your kid, people don't seem to wake up. Like, and I know there's like lots of historical and racial, I'm not denying that, but I'm just going like, when you go, it's sad. I go like, it is sad. It is what it is. And we have to like, on some level, we have to, until you can bring it home and make somebody believe it's relevant to their family, they don't seem to move on it.
If the analysis is a family analysis, I agree with you. I hear you. I get it. That makes sense. But that's not where systemic racism is taking place. It isn't at the family level, right? It's really at the black and white level, or depending on the community, the Latino and white level, or Asian. And there it's taught. It's not a natural instinct.
Okay, right. I hear you. And like, we want to go to all the systemic racism stuff, but I want to go, like, when I think about probation and parole.
Yeah.
To bring it back to what you're working on right now. Here's my question is, when I talk to parole officers, cops, in my old life, I got to do that. Yeah, got to talk to people like, occasionally I'll be in a prison visiting somebody. So I felt like they just had contempt for offenders. Like they just had like a negative attitude about people in the system. And I know that there was a racial component to it. I'm not denying that. But like, I felt like the attitude of parole officers and like towards the people that they were supervising was always so, I assume you're a piece of garbage that's not going to be able to do very well. Like I felt like they were just negative. Am I wrong about that? That there's just a general negativity about the people that are supervising people towards their supervisees?
I think there's a range. I think you definitely have a large number of folks like what you're describing. You also have, for example, you have more women in as probation and parole officers than you do as police officers, for example. More women of color. And I don't think you have that same kind of energy or outlook in the ways you're talking. I mean, okay. I think research even shows that departments that are diverse, both in terms of race and gender, have less complaints, right? And so I'm using that and saying probation and parole departments are way more diverse, both in terms of race and gender, than other departments. So I think you have less than that. So that's why I don't want to paint probation and parole.
So you're like, the problem with the parole system and the probation system is not like they're a bunch of racist, mean, angry people.
Some are.
But like, but you're like, there's a systemic, like the way that we operate those systems, you're like, there's something wrong with the actual, like the sentences and the rules.
We've moved rehabilitation from the center, right? And these systems are governed by fear. Like I said, fear that
somebody on parole would do something wrong.
And so you got to manage.
Willie Horton.
You have to manage for that as a parole officer. And if someone is coloring outside the lines, no, you send them back. That's the problem with it, because I think it's a waste of resource to do that. The percentage of people that will commit serious crime versus the percentage of people you could actually help contribute to society, it's a huge missed opportunity when you don't focus on the helping part and only focus on the managing part.
But when I said Willie Horton, that's the funny thing, isn't it? Like, you could run a really great probation system that worked 99.9% of the time. And if one of your probation people commits that crime, then they put them on the news or some politician makes an example and everybody goes like, the system doesn't work. It's really interesting how like 99 successes and one failure.
That's what needs to change about policymaking, public safety policymaking, is because it's often shaped in moments or by moments of crisis, right? So there's a horrible thing that happens, you know, someone gets kidnapped and murdered and mm-hmm. lawmakers show up that next Monday after getting a weekend of terrible press, and they have to pass new laws. Yeah. That's how a lot of, in terms of our criminal justice system, was created and shaped in moments and because of moments of crisis. And we need to move away from that. We absolutely need to create space for victims of crime to be heard, give them what they need to heal, and support them. But the policy-making conversations need to be driven by data and what works, and not driven by emotion.
Robert Rooks, head of reform, how do you make that shift? As an activist, how do you try to shift the way in which laws get? I mean, because isn't that a big part of your work, is trying to get different kinds of laws and policies on the books?
Yeah, so every state is different. You have some states that are egregious, right? Your home state, unfortunately, where someone can be on probation or parole for 40 years, theoretically. And then there are other states, like I think Massachusetts is doing a much better job, California is doing a much better job, that are trying to figure its way out. So you have to analyze state by state what's going on.
But like, pick a state that you're working in. Like, where's the place where you're working?
Illinois right now. We're in the Illinois legislature. Right now. The bill there, for example, I'll give you one piece of it. We learn as a country that you can work better with people on probation and parole through Zoom check-ins, right? So instead of someone getting on the bus or getting in a car,
five buses
going across town, you can actually Zoom with your probation officer, answer the questions you need to answer, get off and go to work or do something productive.
Or you're at work and you can do it on your lunch break instead of having to take a day off of work and maybe lose your job.
Exactly. So we learned that. So remote reporting is something that we've been pushing since we've learned this lesson in COVID. And that's on the table right now in the state of Illinois, and hoping it's going to pass.
And what's your job? What does reform do in Illinois? Like, did you write the bill? Do you go to legislators and lobby? Like, what do you guys do?
So the first thing we do when we go into a state, and there's a lot of reasons why we go into a state, but the main and most consistent one is we were asked to come into a state. Okay, so there was a Illinois lawmaker that asked us to come into Illinois. And the first thing we did was to convene a table of stakeholders and ask them what their experiences were, what was working and not working about the justice system, about the probation and parole system. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then we shape policy around those conversations.
So you bring these Illinois people together, you say, what's going on here? You bring some of your ideas that you learned in other places.
Correct.
And you come up with like an idea, like in this case, remote reporting.
Correct.
And you say to those stakeholders, what about remote reporting? And they go like, yeah, that would be a good thing.
Or they say to us, right? We're not always the experts in the room. We actually try to create a dynamic where they tell us what they want to see, and then we add what our experiences are and come up with a policy that works for everyone.
And then you sort of go like, okay, this is our idea. In this case, remote reporting would be a really good thing. And then do you sit down with that lawmaker and you help him write a bill about remote reporting?
Absolutely. The lawmakers in states like Illinois have amazing and competent staff. And so basically what they would do is to signal to their staff that working with us is a priority. And their staff would sit down with our staff. We have an amazing group of lawyers and former policymakers and folks that know how to write legislation. And so they'll get together with the staff of lawmaker and write the piece of legislation and then come up with a strategy for how to get it passed.
And I would assume that then the second part of your job, after you've worked with stakeholders to come up with a policy, worked with a legislator to turn it into an actual proposal or bill, do you go out and like grassroots try to get people to write to their legislator and say, pass this bill? And do you talk to the other legislators and explain to them why this bill is such a good idea?
It depends on the strategy. If we take the lead from the coalition and from the lawmaker, sometimes the strategy is to not do anything public, because there needs to be a series of conversations that has to happen, like, for example, with law enforcement. If there's a tenuous relationship between law enforcement and that lawmaker, they may not want us to blitz the Capitol with the bill. Mm-hmm. They may rather us just sit down and have conversations and a meeting of the minds with law enforcement, which sometimes that's the better way to go. But in other states, it's, hey, this is a bill that a lot of people care about. We want to make it a big deal. We want to have it front and center in media, and we deliver that as well. So we're flexible. For us, every piece of legislation we've done has been bipartisan. We've always reached across the aisle to work with folks on the right, with folks on the left, with both conservatives and law enforcement leaders. Because listen, you can pass whatever law you want. After you pass the law, it's going to be law enforcement that's going to have to implement the law. So you might as well bring them to the table early, as opposed to try to do this over their backs. It just doesn't. I've done this work long enough to know that if you don't do that, the policy is not going to, it's got to be, it's not going to be sustainable.
It won't be implemented well.
Correct. So just do it. Just do it on the front end. You know, compromise is the name of the game. You know, you give up something, they give up something, but you do it, you know, in good faith, and you come up with a piece of legislation that's going to help people.
You know, you mentioned like, yeah, there's this county in California that I really like they're doing it right. Like there's a place up in Massachusetts, I think you said, that's good. You go like Philadelphia, not so much.
I'm sorry.
You know, and so it's, I just want to know, like, I don't know why it's hard, so hard for me to say this, but like I was in favor of the legalization of gay marriage, mm-hmm. right? And then when the Supreme Court passed its judgment, I was happy, but I didn't actually go like, you know what? I was a big part of making that happen. I was, you know, supportive and everything. Sure. And I told my friends, but like that happened without my assistance.
Right.
If you know what I'm saying, like without my active assistance. And then there are other things where I go like, we ran this through this birthday party for this guy in the neighborhood that was a real game changer in his life. And I go like, that was my idea. I made that happen. Without me, that wouldn't happen at all.
Right.
And then there are things in between where I feel like I contributed to something good happening. Is there any place in the country where you've seen a change in the way that probation or parole is being managed where you go like, you know what? I think we did something.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think we, yeah. Like where's a place where you go like, things are better in this state because of us? Like where's some place where there's a change that you feel like we had a hand in that?
So California, in the state of California, people were on probation upwards of 5 years or so. Long time on probation in a massive state where a massive bureaucracy was created to manage.
Yeah.
And we worked to pass legislation whereby you're on probation if you have a misdemeanor for 1 year and felony for two, and you're off. And what that did was it allowed for the state to actually save some money and use that money in ways to help people. So diversion programs was created. Programs like this El Dorado County was created, maybe not exactly from that pot, but it's just when you free money up, you just are able to do so many different innovative things. And yeah, I'm excited and proud of the work we did in California. And I think California is a torchbearer for many states, so it should be. I know a lot of states don't want to look at California, but the truth of the matter is it's a big state. It's a state where the dollars are really high in terms of expense and costs, and people have to manage that. And if I'm a state in the center part of the country, I would look and see what they're doing right on this issue for sure.
No. And on some level, there's some kid, there's some young person or some older person, but like somebody who gets put on probation and they're on it for a year and then it comes off and their life is significantly better. Like they're like,
100%. Okay.
You know, than it would have been if they, for 5 years, are carrying around, having to report, having to do all the stuff.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's money that gets freed up. There's that kid's life gets freed up. His family, like he can go to the family barbecue instead of, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Instead of going to parole meeting. And it's interesting because I think like, if you know, I'm a therapist.
Okay.
And you know, if you said like, hey, come to see me once every week or every 2 weeks, that a hassle? And they'd be like, oh yeah, it's a huge commitment to go see somebody twice a month. You know, you have to arrange your transportation, your childcare and all this stuff. And so the idea that you would free somebody up and say like, hey, I've got two appointments a month or an appointment a week that you don't have to go to. Like you've just changed you would have changed my life.
Yeah, no, thank you for laying it out that way. There's so many different perspectives and ways to see that. And I I appreciate that example. And you're 100% right. I mean, what people on probation and parole have to deal with when they're, it really feels un-American, to be honest. I mean, you know, if I, a father, and my son plays a Little League game, if I'm in Philly and he's playing a game in Camden,
yeah,
I can't go. If I go, I'm outside of, you know, the rules of what I'm supposed to do while on probation. I risk going back in. You know, if I'm, you know, I know with DoorDash and, you know, things are different now, but if my child felt ill and I needed to get, you know, medicine at CVS and it's 8 o'clock and it's past curfew, or another issue, I have, you know, folks on my staff that are impacted and currently on probation parole, and they'll talk about how their ankle bracelet, if the battery dies, that's also something that could result. And so you have parents with their kids sitting by the bed, charging the battery, trying to parent from that position, you know, and these are young kids.
Yeah. And what's funny, it's like, we've talked a bit about probation. We haven't even gone to parole. And parole's, like, to me, if probation is a monster, parole is like a three-headed monster, because everybody I know that comes out on parole, you can't get a job.
Yeah.
And maybe on probation you can't get a job, but like on parole, it's hard to get a job.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I got a nephew that just got out in Texas in December, and I'm going through this with him, right? I mean, I'm, you know, supporting him every way that I can. I'm upset by his treatment. His parole officer literally calls my sister. His nephew's like 31. Calls my sister, where is he? And my sister would be like, well, what is his mind to say? What is his mind to say he should be? Oh, he's at this address. Yes, that's his work address. You know, he's a welder, right? So he was able to get a job as a welder. And so they can be menacing too. And menacing not just to the person, but to the entire family. And if I can imagine him not having the supports that he has, how that could just totally discourage you and just make you not even want to cooperate at some point. Because that's in addition to life. Like, life is still happening to you, right? Like, you're going to work. You might have bad days. You might have coworkers that you have issues. Like, life is still happening to you.
Your girlfriend might break up with you.
Stuff like that.
It's crazy, too, because I think about, like, since we're having a conversation, this may surprise you, Robert, but some people close to me would say that I have some control issues.
You're human.
That I tend to, right? I think I know better how people should live their lives and stuff like that, right?
Okay.
And so when I was a minister, like, I had a license to, like, mess with people's lives. I have to struggle in therapy not to tell people what to do. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, listen, here's what you just do. If you made me a parole officer, I mean, I just think, like, it's just dangerous to put somebody in control of somebody's life out there in the world. Because I just might be like, I don't think that's a good job for you. Or like, I don't like who you're hanging around with. If I have some way of, I might even in my own way think I was doing it in your best interest, like keeping you away from people you shouldn't be with. I don't think you should live with your parents. They're not good people. Like, you know, whatever. But like, I just think it's really dangerous to have a system where somebody, like, control over somebody, but they're not responsible for that. Like it's one thing for me to control my children, but I also feed my children and provide a home for them. But it's one thing, like, I have control, but you're responsible to get a job. You're responsible to feed yourself. You're responsible to do all these things. I'm just thinking, like, just on a pure level of, there would have to be some serious checks and balances. Cause, like, I think I would be a really dangerously controlling parole officer.
Well, first of all, I appreciate your transparency, and we need more people to be transparent like that. Because it's real. I mean, we're humans, you know, and we're all cut and shaped differently. And what I hear, especially in, you know, the hip hop world, right? Because of me, we work with artists, and a lot of them are on parole. They have to send in their checks. They have to send in how much money they've made last month. And you're talking about a parole officer that maybe 30 years old, right?
Not making a lot of money.
Not
feeling empowered.
Right. And then seeing these checks, and it's like, how do they negotiate power? in that situation, right? It's just, that's a lot for a young person to have to figure out. And so what they often do is they show power, you know, how they can control people. They exert power. And that's just not necessary, you know? And this one guy I'm talking about, he's supposed to be on parole. This guy just signed one of the largest podcast deals in the country. You know, well-known podcast guy was on parole till 2047 or something like that. It's insane.
I had no idea parole lasted that long.
In your state.
No, my home state. I had no idea they could keep, like, the idea that Meek Mill was on probation for 10 years.
Yeah.
If you need to be on probation for 10 years, you should go to jail. If you're so bad that we got to watch you for 10 years, you shouldn't be on probation. And if you should be on probation, if that's the right thing for you, it should be over in a year or two, right?
And I'm so glad you said that, because inherently, definitionally, when you go on probation or when you are released on parole, the system is saying you are no longer a threat, or you're not a threat to yourself or someone else. That's what it's saying, right? And so why? What's the justification for 2047?
That's crazy.
Makes no sense, you know? Yeah. But yeah, that's the system we're trying to fix at Reform.
All right. So listen, I'm going to bring this to a point, because if I'm listening to you right now, like I am listening to you right now, but if I'm a podcast person listening to you and me right now, like some of the stuff I talk about, like listening, like I'll talk to a psychologist about listening skills, right? And the person out there is like, I can use that with my wife tonight. Like I can use that with my kid. They're thinking like, I can apply this new knowledge, or I can apply this new motivation in my life. Sometimes when I'm talking to you, I'm thinking like, if Joe Johnson is out there in Poughkeepsie, New York, and he goes like, gosh, I had no idea that the parole and, you know, probation system was so bad. Like, obviously one thing he can do is like, he can whip out his checkbook and he can write a check to, you know, Reform. But like, that's obvious. And then they're like, we'll take care of it for you, Bart. But like, when you just talk to like a person in the neighborhood or a person who, and you make them aware of this, and they go like, what? 2047? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
What are they to do? Like, what do you want people to do?
So one of the things that I added when I came on to Reform to our mission was economic mobility, right? So I have the view and perspective, and the board supports me on this, that we can shake our finger all we want at state governments and tell them to change their laws. But until we are seen as stakeholders, right, it's until we are helping them solve problems, right, we won't get okay. the reform and the impact we want, right? So that's okay. my theory of change. And so we have added economic pathways program and agenda to our work. We do large-scale employment fairs where we bring corporations together to hire people coming out of the system, people on probation and parole. We've held three pretty large events. One was in partnership with the New York Knicks. About 6,000 people registered and came through the door. The other was with Brooklyn Nets. About 4,500 people came through the door. And then we partnered with Philadelphia 76ers. It was awesome. It was amazing. Again, large scale. When you walk in, people are getting a haircut. People are getting resume coaching and support.
Trying to help ex-offenders get jobs?
Yeah, and we're giving away free suits, right? We're trying to cover the whole gamut. Here's what you need. Look good, feel good, perform. And it's been great. And what I've loved about this piece most has been how corporations have come and rallied around and want to know how they can be helpful. And so we all either run an organization or company or work in an organization and company. And I think the best thing people can do is to ask their companies what their current policies are for hiring people with felonies or people on probation and parole. Ask those policies to be changed and updated so they can become a second chance hiring company, and then begin hiring people and promoting people that was impacted by the system. I think that's the number one thing people can do. It's okay. not write a check to Reform. That's fine. Right. We're going to do the work.
If we could create better second chance hiring opportunities for people.
Changes everything.
Yeah.
I mean, what people need coming out is jobs, housing, and supportive services.
I'm going to take you all the way back to your original father of parole, whose name I can't remember.
John Augustus.
John Augustus. I want to take you back to John, because I feel like if you just go like, I'm going to hire ex-offenders, and you're just like, okay, now ex-offenders can get jobs here. Like, I think that would be scary for some people, but I also don't know that it would, like, I think you have to know who you're hiring and know, like, how do I support an ex-offender? What do I need to know? So like, I'm guessing that you have some best practices for second chance hiring. If I'm an employer, if I go to my employer and say, hey, are we secondhand hiring? And he goes, no, but I'm interested. Tell me, like, where would I get the resource to know how to become a good second chance hirer?
So a couple of things. One, Reform organizes a best practices training for companies. We don't do it ourselves. We convene it, and then we bring in consultants and leaders in this space to actually train the companies.
So I could reach out to you and say, like, look, we want to get right on this.
Yes.
We don't know how. And you would say like, oh, listen, we'll hook you up. We'll introduce you to the right people.
Yeah. So the folks, you know, Dave's Killer Bread. You eat Dave's Killer Bread? It's good bread. Are you familiar with Dave's?
No, I never heard of it.
Oh, gosh. You got to go to your local grocery store. Dave's Killer Bread is a bread company founded by someone that was justice impacted and has hired justice impacted folks to run it. It's really good bread. But also, he's a leader. And what he's been able to do is educate and transform companies all across the country on what they can do to hire and support just impacted folks. There's another organization, Responsible Business Initiative. They also provide training. So we're a convener of sorts where we know who the best people are. If corporations reach out to us, we'll convene them and let the best folks train them and hopefully institute new policies and programs.
Right, and I'm assuming like it might be a corporation or it might be like a guy running a welding shop for 10 people. And you go like, I still want to learn.
Yeah, 100%. 100%, because when my nephew takes his break, you know, he can only go so many places. Maybe he can go to his car, but he'll go and set up his, you know, his Zoom for his meeting. It's important that his employer knows what's going on. And knows how to support him, right? Yeah. So if something happens in his area, just wait 10 minutes. Don't come in yelling at him. Like, wait 10 minutes, let him do his meeting, and then he'll be there. So those types of things are what's needed. But also what we're finding out too, Bart, is, you know, people are getting hired, but they're not getting promoted, right? It's because all these stipulations weigh people down. Remember we talked about people still have to have life. They still have life on top of supervision. What that life plus the supervision is keeping people at one level. Like, how do we get people in these companies and promoted so they can have careers? So how do you go from jobs to careers? That's another thing that's really important.
Well, that's a place to start for me. I mean, like, that's like, I go like, okay, I've heard something. And I go like, the thing I probably ought need to be thinking about is, it's almost like affordable housing for homelessness. You're like, yeah, you're going to have homelessness. And you're like, well, should I take them soup or should I, you know, bring blankets? And like, you know, you should really be thinking more about affordable housing.
That's right.
On this level, you go like, yeah, there's policies and all that stuff. That's important. But we also need to think about like, where do these people land?
Yeah.
And so that's a really helpful framing for me. As I go like, okay, now I know that when I think about what happened with Meek Mill and all of that stuff, and I go like, that whole issue, wow, I'm aware of that now. And I sort of go like, what's the thing I need to be thinking about? Is I need to be thinking about like, where do these people go to work?
Where we're trying to move the conversation, and we're going to do more of this as an organization in the coming months and year, is to focus on solutions. We need to elevate solutions, especially in the moment that we're in post-COVID. We've seen an increase in violent crime all across the country. Hasn't been because of criminal justice reform. Red states, we've seen an increase in violent crime. Blue states, we've seen an increase in violent crime. There's been an increase. Why? Because we were separated for 2.5 years.
Yeah, messed up a lot of
people. Separated from each other, separated from the institution.
You talk to any school teacher, they'll tell you that school's a mess. And if school's a mess, that means there's a lot of young people that are
in the
messed
community.
Up. Yeah, they're in the community.
And so with those of us that care about this issue and that work on this issue, we have to be more solutions oriented. Like, we can't just be advocating for policies without helping these governments figure out like how to address the root cause or bring real solutions to the table. I think that's the future of those that do our work.
Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah,
I mean it's interesting because you know in the end, I mean I know this sounds really trite. Like I feel like I'm back in my preaching days, but like when somebody commits a crime, you know, one way of viewing it is an indication of unworthiness, and another way of looking at it is a cry for help.
100%. It is a cry for help. Society also needs to see accountability if society is going to have trust in the system. So accountability is important. But one can hold someone accountable and still recognize it as a cry for help, which is why I really appreciate what you're saying. And that's what we don't do.
Yeah,
we don't recognize it as a cry for help. So our systems manage and punish as opposed to finding out how to help.
Yeah. Yeah, this is good, man. I'm taking all your time. And
no.
I mean, you and I, we could go all night, but like people don't listen to podcasts that are 7 hours long. So,
I hear that.
So this is good. I mean, I feel like bringing it around to the jobs thing, you know, will be helpful for me because I go like, okay, I met somebody, they're doing something cool, but what does that have to do with my life? And I go like, okay, this is a place where, you know, it applies. Again, literally, most of the people listening to my podcast have never been in a prison.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, most people, you know, like it's funny how many people have never been inside a prison. Yeah. And so like they don't really understand what that is or what it means when you violate somebody's parole. They just don't know what you're sending them back to.
It just doesn't serve the public at all. And so we're trying to find that middle ground where there's accountability.
This will sound stupid. Did you see that movie, Emily the Criminal?
No.
Have you heard of it?
I wish I had more time for movies.
I don't tell you. No, the reason is because the movie shows this woman sort of, she comes out of the system and she struggles to find meaningful work. And her parole officer is not very understanding and this and that. And she ends up becoming a hardcore criminal because it's just too hard for her to make it under the rules and regulations that are stipulated upon her. It's a very popular movie on Netflix right now.
Let me say this. I know we're wrapping up.
Yeah, yeah.
If the criminal justice systems or these probation parole systems was a business, it would have failed a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I would love for probation officers to be incentivized instead of the incentive being, don't let me see your person on the nightly news, be, hey, you'll get a raise if 15% of your caseload, right, gets jobs, you know, next year, or 30% or 50%, like a stable, like let's incentivize the things that we want, the things that we know people need to be successful. Yeah. But we don't do that. We're incentivizing fear. And that is a failed system.
Yeah. No, I think it's really true. And I mean, my wife works for this homelessness organization in Pasadena remotely. We used to live in LA. And so she worked for them and she still works for them. But like one of the interesting things is, you know, like when you work with homelessness, you can measure by like, how many people did you feed this week? How many people did you have in your shelter this week? And increasingly they're like, you know, we probably ought to be measuring like, how many people do we house this week? How many people do we get? Did we help find sustainable housing? You know, because like
100%.
You know, you end up measuring
failure.
Failure. You end up measuring like how well are you at managing failure?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. So you got kids. You got three kids. I saw that in your bio. How old are they?
18, 17, and 15-year-old that will be 16 next month.
You really don't have a lot of time to watch movies, do you?
Well, we do the whole like, you know, Marvel or teenage thing. We do that as a family. But yeah, no, it's either work or it's the kids. That's, you know, and I love being a father of teenage boys, man. It's the best.
Oh, man. I'm really glad to meet you. And I appreciate, you know, again, the Philly connection is real. Like where I go like, oh yeah, Meek Mill, I remember that. And the wheelies that he was popping, like, I've seen those wheelies a million times, you know. I know they're illegal, but they're fun to watch. I know his street was blocked off. Don't get me wrong. I know.
Yeah, he was doing a music video.
I know.
He was working.
I know. That was my sort of initial connection in. But like, I appreciate your story. And I think one of the things I appreciate about most, and like, this doesn't have to show up anywhere, but like, there's something about somebody becoming engaged in an issue through personal experience with people that they love. But not through personal experience. Like that was my, like I was in the, you know, like there's something exciting for me about somebody who could have taken their life in a lot of other directions, you know, more lucrative directions. And I appreciate that.
You know, I appreciate that too. You know, what's interesting for me, and I'll go, you're right, we can keep talking all day, was what I felt society was asking of me was to move on. And I couldn't move on. Like, this is the guy that taught me so much, you know, that I looked up to, that I love. He was my guy. And he was gone. Like, he's not coming back. And we were just supposed to move on. And that just wasn't what I was willing to do.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. I really appreciate it. It means a lot. There's a kind of credibility that you get doing anything of value when you could do something else.
Thank you, man.
All right. Talk to you later. All right. So that was it. There it was. That was me and Robert Rooks. We were talking, came up with stuff you can do, came up with good things. If you know somebody who cares about prisoners, connected to prisoners, who's been touched by the criminal justice system, this might be an episode to share. Like, not because it's like, oh, they'll fall in love with Humanize Me and they'll listen to all our episodes, but just because, like, I think that this is an aspect of the problem that doesn't get talked about very much. And yet it's a place where people like you and I can have a big impact. So there. But another thing that I'm really grateful for always are the people that think that these conversations that we have are so worthwhile that they're worth supporting, and that support us through Patreon, which enables us to keep spending the time and spending the money to keep the thing going. And today I want to thank Nick Acasella and Curtis Cannon and Chuck Jones and Jay Chung. And in a nod to Taco 54, Partition. Again, like, I'd love to know the story behind that. Nom de plume. Nathan Delgado, David Buckley, Ed Good, and last but certainly not least, my own dear son, Roman. Yeah, all of you, I appreciate you. All of you are part of what makes this whole thing keep going. And we need these conversations. I do. Like, I need them. I need to have them. I need to hear them. This is good stuff. And I'm really grateful that you're part of it. And I will see you all next time on Humanize Me.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. You'll also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith, me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. Hey, you could be larger than life.